I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Former President Bill Clinton is in Wisconsin today, campaigning ahead of next Tuesday's recall, an election that's attracting national attention because it's seen as a proxy battle between pro- and anti-union forces pouring money and people into the state. And Wisconsin is one of a handful of states that could decide the presidential election. You'll remember Democrats forced this recall after Republican Governor Scott Walker's moves to effectively end collective bargaining rights for most state workers. Clinton is backing the Democrat, Tom Barrett, current mayor of Milwaukee. Walker's been leading in the polls, and today he's out campaigning with the GOP rising star, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. Mary Spicuzza is with the Wisconsin State Journal. And Mary, the Washington Post is calling this recall election an uncivil war. How would you characterize it?
That sounds pretty accurate to me. It has been very, very heated, and it's funny because I feel like a lot of people think of Wisconsin or thought of Wisconsin as, you know, friendly, happy people who say hi to each other on the street. Mm-hmm. And now it has gotten so heated that there was a recent poll that about a third of the people asked said that they had actually stopped speaking to someone about politics because of the recall.
We heard this in the debate yesterday, the last one, between Mayor Barrett and Governor Walker. Sharp exchanges over ads, job stats. Mayor Barrett saying, my police department arrests felons, the governor hires them. He's referring to an investigation that's dogged Governor Walker. Could you just tell us briefly about that?
Sure. That dates back to his time as Milwaukee County Executive, and there have been a number of his former aides, as well as former appointees, who have actually been charged with felonies and with other crimes, tying back to illegal campaign work that was done on taxpayer time, apparently a secret email system that was set up within the county executive's office that seemed to be hidden inside an armoire. One appointee was accused of stealing money from veterans groups. It's really, because it is a secret investigation, it's very hard to tell where it's going or who else may be involved. Close associates of Governor Walker have been charged, but no charges have been made public that the governor himself is facing at this point.
Well, Tom Barrett is facing some questions of his own. He was quoting statistics apparently showing that crime in Milwaukee was going down. They turned out to be wrong. Deliberate slip-up? What's that?
You know, that has been a huge issue in this campaign and something that Governor Walker and his supporters have been really raising questions about. Mayor Barrett said in the debate last night that, those were errors that he did not know about originally that they're working to correct. But again, I think it's hard to, sometimes time tells, and it's hard to tell exactly how that happened.
Well, meanwhile, another debate is over jobs. We're going to be talking later about jobs and the new numbers, but Governor Walker campaigned on bringing 250,000 jobs to Wisconsin. That hasn't happened. Democrats now saying Wisconsin is the worst performer in the country, but Republicans saying the stats do show job increases. So, again, this division. And Mayor Barrett has been using quotes from something that Scott Walker said to a billionaire donor, saying he was going to divide and conquer. How's that playing out?
Yes, there was a video that surfaced recently that was filmed in January 2011 before Governor Walker unveiled his collective bargaining proposal, where a billionaire donor asked him about making Wisconsin a right-to-work state. She asked him about going after the unions, and he mentioned his collective bargaining proposal that he was going to be rolling out and then said, mentioned divide and conquer. And the Barrett campaign has seized on that, saying he has achieved his goals, not in terms of creating jobs, but in terms of dividing the state.
Well, putting that aside, hasn't Governor Walker already won at least in one battle? We're reading a story in the Wall Street Journal that shows that Wisconsin's second largest union membership fell from 62,000 to 26,000, 50% drop in 1 year. Now, Governor Walker says that's not wasn't his intent when he went after bargaining rights. He wasn't trying to bust the unions, but his opponents say he was. It looks like at least membership is down.
I would say that this has been an incredibly difficult time for unions in Wisconsin. You know, we've seen a lot of retirements, public workers going into retirement earlier than they had planned because, you know, some of them have said that this was too hard for them. This made their decision that they would just leave and retire.
Well, we'll see how Wisconsinites feel about that on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Mary Spicuzza of the Wisconsin State Journal, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Well, our conversation today is about a false rape accusation. It may not be for children, and it's also a topic that riles adults. Some argue that the number of false rape accusations is so small that to mention it at all distracts from the serious problem of real rapes. Some men's rights groups argue that false rape accusations are a huge problem. Well, Emily Bazelon takes a terrific look at this in Slate. She says the most trusted research shows that only about 10% of rape accusations are false, but that means that using stats that show about 200,000 rapes in a year, 20,000 were false. This makes police and juries less likely to believe real rape victims, and of course, it's a nightmare for the accused. Like Brian Banks. He's the former high school football star who went to prison at 17 for a rape he didn't commit. He served 5 years, and then last week, 5 years after his release, his name was finally cleared. His accuser admitted she lied. Brian is a symbol of false accusations, but also another problem with courts, as we're going to hear. He joins us from NPR West in Culver City. Brian Banks, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Also with you, we know, is your new lawyer, Justin Brooks, who heads the California Innocence Project. Justin, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much.
Brian, let's go back to when you were a teenager, 16 years old. You and a young lady named Juanetta Gibson had a kissing relationship, but then she accused you of rape. Explain how you ended up in jail. You pled guilty, in essence.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've always stood by my innocence. From day one on July 8th of 2002, when the accusation was first made, she and I went to an area on campus, and we made out, but we never had sex. The day of jury selection, my lawyer at the time pulled me out of the holding cell and told me that she had put together a deal with the district attorney, and that deal was one of the two. One, I face 41 years to life in prison if I take this thing to trial. And I'd be viewed as a big black teenager by the jury, and I'd automatically be assumed guilty.
Your lawyer said that to you?
Her exact words. The other option was for me to take a plea bargain, plead no contest to one count of rape. And even though no contest is a plea that doesn't necessarily say that I'm saying I'm guilty, it does carry the weight and burden of a guilty plea. So I was left with two options, plea and hopefully receive a minimum amount of time or face my entire life behind bars. And so I was left with a decision to make, and I made what I felt was the best decision in getting home as soon as I can. But unfortunately, I was pretty much railroaded into a completely different situation.
And that's where Brian's story really has broader implications. I mean, the Supreme Court recently recognized that plea bargains have become 95% of the criminal justice system. And the court talked about the fact that we've got to kind of consider it as the entire criminal justice system and extend, you know, the right to counsel and effective assistance of counsel to the plea bargaining process. Because you've got a 17-year-old kid who's sitting in a room and deciding between, you know, this minimum sentence, or he goes to trial, rolls the dice, and he's looking at 41 years
well,
in prison.
And he's already heard from his lawyer that she doesn't sound like she has faith in this. And I just, to give this more context, you are a football star, Brian. You come from an intact two-parent family. Doesn't sound like you'd been in a lot of trouble. There was no record that was going to be brought up. It sounds like it was just going to be a he said, she said. Justin, would you have agreed that in that situation he would have had no chance?
No, not at all. You know, when we went to the high school where this incident was alleged to have occurred, you know, Brian was charged with kidnapping. And the statement was that Brian had dragged this girl through the school, and it's a long distance down hallways and stairwells. And when we went to the school, he would have had to pass classrooms where there were classes going on. There was teachers there, and it was absolutely impossible that it occurred the way that she said it occurred. On top of that, the rape kit was taken on the day of the incident, and there was no semen found. And she had said in her statement that he ejaculated. So that negative semen and DNA evidence is compelling in this case, whereas it isn't in other cases. So this case was winnable, and a lot of it is based on how an attorney presents a plea bargain to a client.
So you go serve 5 years. What are you thinking when you're in jail?
How did I get here? Why wasn't my side of the story heard? Why wasn't the case investigated further? You know, keep in mind, I had already sat in juvenile hall for a year before I took this plea, and then being presented with an option of facing life in prison, you know, you just want to do whatever you can and get out as soon as you can.
Possibly get reduced time.
And that's how innocent people can get caught in it. You can actually make a reasonable decision, even if you're innocent, to plea. And I think that's something we really haven't talked much about in this country.
Well, but what does it do to your life? What kind of trajectory were you on? Had you, applied to colleges yet? What was going on?
At the time, I had just accepted a verbal offer from USC on a full scholarship. I was entering into my senior year, projected to be the defensive leader and team leader of my high school football team. I was being recruited by almost every Division I university that you can think of. And I hadn't even played my senior year in high school.
What about socially? Did people believe this about you?
The community always had my back. They always knew the truth. They know my character. They know my family and how we were raised and how we were brought up. And it just made no sense that I'd be accused of such a crime.
Well, so you come out of jail. You confront what many do. I'm presuming you had a record, not just of being in jail, but on a sex offense.
That's right.
So what first, are you listed as a sexual predator when you come out?
Yeah, I had to register with the local police department. I was placed on parole. I was required to wear a GPS monitoring device on my ankle for nearly 5 years. I had curfews, not being able to live within 2,000 feet of any school or park. Having to charge this GPS on my ankle twice a day, every 12 hours, for an hour. And it was a constant reminder of everything that I've been through.
Well, I'm sure it didn't make for a great thing on your resume.
Not at all. Yeah. That's definitely been one of the hardest things for me is trying to find any type of employment. I've always been to interviews. They love my personality. They love my character. But when it came down to a background check or asking me if I had any past criminal history, you know, I couldn't even say, a while ago. On the opposite, it was, I'm currently on parole. I currently have a tracking device on my ankle. I currently have a parole officer. And if I get this job, this parole officer is going to want to come to this office. He's going to want to check in and see who you are. He's going to want to be able to surprise me at this job and come and report. And no company, no job wanted that, let alone hire a sex offender.
That's Brian Banks talking about his life as an accused rapist. But just recently, his accuser told him she'd lied. We're also speaking with Brian's lawyer, Justin Brooks, of the California Innocence Project at California Western School of Law. When we come back, what happened next for Brian Banks? If you haven't heard it, it's pretty incredible. That's in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Brian Banks, former high school football star who plea bargained and went to prison for 5 years at the age of 17 for a rape he did not commit. We're also speaking with his lawyer, Justin Brooks, of the California Innocence Project at California Western School of Law, who mentioned a moment ago last month's Supreme Court decision in which justices noted that about 95% of convictions are now the result of plea bargains, and they need to be reexamined. The court ruling that defendants have the right for a second chance at accepting an offer if they're given bad advice by a lawyer, as we heard Brian certainly was. In any event, Brian went to jail. Then last week, something incredible happened. He sat in a courtroom and a judge absolved him of the crime. Brian, take us back. One day recently, your accuser, Juanetta Gibson, sent you a Facebook friend request. She wanted to meet with you. You meet with her. She tells you she lied. What are you thinking?
Well, I was relieved to hear her say the words that I've been waiting to hear so long. You know, for so long, I've reached out to multiple attorneys and different organizations and trying to get help. So I was all out of options. until I received that Facebook friend request.
Yeah.
And until she appeared at this private investigation office and began telling the truth.
Well, it's slowly, though, because we know she said she wanted to help you clear your name but didn't want to lose a $1.5 million payment from a civil suit that she received after you were jailed. The school was sued. So then your new defense wires you, and you capture this confession on tape that she had lied. Justin Brooks, what did you do with that tape?
Well, I brought it to the district attorney's office. And I brought Brian in, and he sat down and talked to the district attorney and told the story from beginning to end. And we presented the video to them, and we told them to go out and talk to her as well. And we did a negotiation process over the next several months to come together on the case.
Yeah.
Now, we weren't sure last week when we went to court whether it was all going to work or not. You know, I had to prepare Brian for that maybe they were going to go forward and then we were going to have a battle on our hands.
Still, even with a taped confession from a woman who says she now lied about being raped, you really doubted it would clear his name?
It would clear his name if we could get it in.
Oh.
But, you know, it was videotaped by a private investigator at his office.
I wondered about that because in, for instance, our state, that would be illegal. You can't tape someone without their knowledge.
Right. There were notices up in the office that said this area is under video surveillance. But whether she particularly knew that, we could have gotten in a battle over it. You're right.
Well, so you get to the court hearing. And as Justin just said, Brian, you had no idea what the outcome was going to be. The outcome was that your case was thrown out. And then further, I believe you had the GPS removed. All of that happened afterwards. Your thoughts in that moment? Your parents are there. It's been 10 years, 11 years. What are your thoughts in that moment?
You know, I was very hopeful. I've been preparing for that moment for so long. And I had my whole family there, my mother, my father, my girlfriend, my friends and supporters. And it was just an amazing moment. It was one of those moments where, you know, finally I can breathe. Finally I can live. And then I just was also just reminded of everything that I've been through to get to that point. And it just was bittersweet. And I'm just overjoyed that it was over, but just still very much in the healing process.
What about Juanetta Gibson? What do you think should happen here?
You know, I still haven't given that thought, and it still hasn't been something that crosses my mind. You know, I've just solely been focused on me, and, you know, regardless of what people are saying, regardless of what people are calling you, regardless of what you've been branded as, how are you going to handle yourself? And that's always been the most important thing to me.
Yeah, Brian is focused on getting into the NFL. And we are going right from this interview to a training facility where he's going to continue his training, get ready for his tryouts. He's an amazing young man. He's very forward-thinking. And he's moving on with his life. He's getting the most out of it.
Well, Justin Brooks, you know, and Brian, this reminds me of that old saying, is there anywhere I can go to get my reputation back? And, you know, you start with the football. There's another football star who was in college when he was falsely accused of attempted murder and carjacking. His name is Justin Smith. He's also trying to get into the NFL. Brian, you're trying to get into the NFL, not having been able to have your scholarship. You were offered at USC. You didn't even get to play in college. So it's a lot to ask the pros to, you know, to look at you. Gil Brandt, an NFL draft consultant, said on the Huffington Post that, you know, you'd be eligible, but years away from a game are hard to overcome.
You know, it's a lot to ask for, but it's also a lot of work that has been put in to me feeling comfortable about making such a request. And I've prepared for this day in and day out. And I would never put myself in a position or in a situation that I wasn't prepared for.
Some people are saying that you and this other fellow, Justin Smith, might actually be stronger candidates for something like the NFL because of what you've been through.
Exactly. Football's a lot about heart. You know, when you play the position that Brian does at linebacker, it's looking at that ball and going for it, looking at that quarterback and going for it. And Brian is the most determined person I've ever met.
And Justin Brooks, again, the lawyer here, just a last thought, that sense of anywhere, where do I go to get my reputation back or the years of income back, jobs missed, are you thinking of suing, and who would you sue?
No, we are not thinking of suing. In fact, that's been misreported. Under California law, you're entitled to $100 a day for every day you've been wrongfully incarcerated from the compensation board. And, you know, I plan on filing an application for that from the state. But again, Brian's moving forward. He hasn't even talked to me about that. That's just something I know I'm going to do because we do it for all our clients that we exonerate.
Well, Brian Banks, we wish you lots of luck in whatever lies ahead for you.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate your interest in the whole situation.
And Justin Brooks, thanks to you as well.
My pleasure.
And by the way, what lies ahead? Next week, Brian has a tryout lined up with the Seattle Seahawks. And next week on Here and Now, a mother who felt her husband, who had a record of abuse, was wrongly given custody of their children, took them, and was granted asylum in the Netherlands. That story next week, Here and Now. There are few countries in the developed world where immigration is not a hot-button political issue. Israel is no exception. In recent weeks, African migrants from countries such as Eritrea and Sudan have been the target of violent attacks by some Israelis who blame them for a rise in crime and antisocial behavior. The government is building a fence along its long border with Egypt to try and stop the flow of thousands of North African migrants. And in the coming days, Israel is expected to deport hundreds of immigrants back to South Sudan. The BBC's John Donison reports.
Ugly scenes in Tel Aviv. A large mob of white Israelis attacks a car with two black Africans inside. They kick and punch the windows, screaming abuse. On the same evening, nearby African businesses were trashed. The violence erupted hours after a demonstration in protest at the number of migrants in the city. The message, you're not welcome. Yael Amrani, a young mother with her toddler clutched to her chest, tells us there's been a rise in crime. She says Africans sexually harass her in the street and have taken over all the housing. She says it doesn't feel like her country anymore. Yael's views are echoed by many of the Israelis at the demo. People say they no longer feel safe on the streets. One elderly man, Israel Harad, offers his solution.
Israel should do like normal countries do, like United States, that shoot the Mexican who tries to enter their borders. They have to shoot them down, simply. After 100, 200 kills, no one will enter here.
Many Israelis would be appalled with such a view, but the language used even by the country's politicians has been uncomfortable. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu condemned the recent violence, but one MP from his own Likud party called African migrants a cancer. Another Likud politician who addressed the rally was Yariv Levine, but he denied accusations of racism.
There is no issue of racism here. I think Israel is proud of being a country that is open to Jewish immigrants from all around the world, whether they came from Asia, from Ethiopia, from Europe.
It's estimated there are around 60,000 African migrants in Israel. That's less than 1% of the population. The majority are from Eritrea and Sudan. Only a handful have been given asylum, and the Israeli government calls them infiltrators, here for economic reasons. In the coming days, it will move to deport over 700 of them. That includes Simon Mayer and his young family. They kick a football around their backyard. Simon works in a local factory. His wife runs a small kindergarten for the African community, but it's been closed for the last month because of fears of attacks. The Israeli government wants to send the family back to South Sudan, saying the world's newest country is safe to return to. When he first came here 5 years ago, crossing illegally through Egypt, Simon, a Christian, says he was proud to be in Israel, but not anymore.
When I brought my kids here, I used to say that one day they will be in Israeli, you know, army. This is reality. Even others' families also used to say that. 2 years later on, we feel something else.
Simon says he would eventually like to settle in South Sudan, but he doesn't feel the country is yet stable enough to do so.
More than 60 years ago, Israel was founded by migrants, people seeking shelter from persecution elsewhere. If you're Jewish, no matter where you come from in the world, you're still virtually guaranteed Israeli citizenship. But this wealthy country sits next door to the world's poorest continent. You look around on the streets of Tel Aviv and you can see there's a whole new wave of migrants. And there's a real debate here about how Israel should respond and whether this state's own history should have any bearing on that response.
The BBC's John Donison in Tel Aviv. We'll be back in 30 seconds with the Jobs Fact Check here and now. The latest jobs numbers are out. Employers creating only 69,000 new jobs in May, the fewest in a year. The unemployment rate ticking up a tenth of a percentage point to 8.2%. The Obama campaign cautioned against reading too much into just one monthly report. Mitt Romney called the numbers devastating. And yesterday, he stood at the shuttered Solyndra factory in California and accused President Obama of destroying jobs by making bad investments with taxpayer money. But our next guest says that Romney conveniently overlooks bad job-destroying investments he made at the private equity firm Bain Capital, that investment is a roll of the dice. And this week, the Obama campaign released this ad using Massachusetts officials to decry Romney's record on jobs when he was governor here.
Massachusetts growth stopped. Companies stopped coming. The new jobs were not being created.
We knew that we were losing manufacturing jobs, and he never found any solutions to try and figure out how do we keep them. By the time Mitt Romney left office, we were 47th in the nation in terms of job growth.
But our next guest says, hold on there, Mitt Romney actually grew more jobs than his critics say. But what about Romney's claim last January that President Obama has actually lost jobs, over 500,000 of them? What is true? Glenn Kessler writes the fact checker column for The Washington Post. Glenn, welcome back.
You're welcome.
Start with the Romney claim that during the Obama administration, jobs have been lost. 500 and something thousand jobs have been lost. What's true?
Well, the question is, when do you start the impact of the Obama presidency? What Romney does is he takes the entire month of January 2009, when 800,000 jobs were lost. Even though Obama only became president on January 20th, he essentially gives Obama the blame for all the jobs lost in that month. So right there, just in that one month, that 800,000, you would make up that 500,000 deficit that he talks about.
The Obama campaign claims to have added 4.25 million private sector jobs just over the last 26 months. So what's the net?
Well, with all these figures, it depends when you start the counting. Romney will start the counting as of January 1st, 2009. When Obama talks about positive job growth, he will only count the months when jobs started to be added back, which is essentially middle of 2010. And then when he says private sector jobs, that's because, frankly, since the stimulus money ran out, public employment has really continued to drop as states have laid off teachers and that sort of thing because they couldn't make their budgets. So if you combine public and private employment, you have, for the Obama presidency, you have this negative number that Romney talks about. But if you take out those public employees and you just focus on private sector growth, you're going to have a nice positive number. It's not a great number, but it's certainly a positive number, and that's what Obama likes to talk about.
Well, and we hear Obama supporters also say that it's not fair to count the public jobs lost because many of those are in states where Republican legislators are firing people.
Well, I think they have a bit of a point there. I put together a graphic where I literally looked at whether there was a difference between Republican governors and Democratic governors or Republican governors and Republican legislatures in terms of public employment growth.
Mm-hmm.
The results were kind of mixed, actually. You saw that in general, Democratic governors did not lay off as many public state employees, but they laid off in their states, more local employees were laid off. It was the opposite with the Republicans. Net-net, they were almost exactly the same. And what that points to is that each state has its own individual employment situation. So it's really hard to make, you know, a hard and fast declaration that the Republicans are laying off public employees.
Well, there you go on that. By the way, you mentioned a graph. What do you make of the bikini graph? It's being called, you know, one cup down, one cup up. President Obama's defenders saying that it shows job loss during President Bush, recovery during Obama.
It's definitely a very plunging bikini. The president did take office in the middle of the worst recession since World War II. And what you, if you look at those numbers at the Bureau of Labor Statistics website, it is stomach-churning. 800,000 jobs lost in January, 750,000 jobs lost in February, right. Another 600,000 jobs lost in March.
Yeah, so let's just stay there for a second, Glenn, because it's worth remembering, you know, now we're rooting for 150,000 jobs to be added every month. It's worth remembering what it was like. There were none added. It was all loss. It was this horrible loss.
Right. So you had, in the first few months of Obama's presidency, 3 million jobs disappeared. And I don't know. What I've tried to argue is that the way to look at Obama's record is to date the job growth from the end of the recession, June 2009. That gives you about 5 months for his policies to start to take effect. Let's not forget the stimulus was passed in February. That's a pretty good baseline to say, all right, what has this president done? And the record from that period, it's positive job growth, but it's not overwhelming and it's a little weak.
What about claims about Mitt Romney's success in creating jobs? The Obama campaign says no new job growth when Romney was governor. We just heard their ad. The Romney campaign claims that in Romney's 4 years as Massachusetts governor, the number of jobs went up by 61,000.
That's correct. It's not a great record. In fact, I was just playing with a chart I'm creating where I overlay the first 40 months of Obama's presidency with first 40 months of Romney's governorship. And the amazing thing about it is the lines on in terms of job creation are virtually identical. Because Romney became governor in the midst of a very bad economic period in Massachusetts.
He also inherited a bad economy.
He did.
Just want to ask, though, you agree with the Romney campaign that there were 61,000 jobs added. But the Boston Globe quotes MoodyEconomies.com saying it was only 24,400 jobs.
Okay. Well, I guess the difference may be in terms of the month you start in, whether you start with December or January.
Well, it's the same. As you said, it's the exact same thing you'd say about President Obama's success if you start
exactly.
Late. Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
What about the car industry? President Obama claims to have saved 1 million jobs when he bailed out the auto industry. The Romney campaign says 100,000 auto industry jobs were lost.
Well, the Obama campaign is a better case there. The million job estimate is actually an estimate that was produced by the Council of Economic Advisers under George W. Bush. And it's based on the fact that not only would General Motors and Chrysler collapse, but all sorts of auto parts suppliers and other companies tied to the success of the auto industry would also fail. The Romney claim of 100,000 job loss, that is based on the period in the first year after Obama became president. Because obviously, in order for those bailouts to be a success, both those companies had to dramatically scale back their dealerships, had to scale back their workforce, they had to shed product lines. So yes, 100,000 jobs or so were lost in that first year. But I looked at the numbers overall since Obama became president. The Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that the number of auto jobs has increased by 50,000 in his presidency.
Okay. Glenn Kessler, he writes the Fact Checker column for The Washington Post. Glenn Kessler, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And after all that, Glenn also says that you really can't parse presidents or governors' jobs, tracks, records because they're part of an economic continuum. But still, we love your thoughts on this at hereandnow.org. It's Here and Now, and it's June. That means the Tonys are coming. The awards for Broadway's Best will be handed out on the 10th. Next week, we'll have a conversation with Tracy Bennett, up for Best Actress in a Play for her channeling of Judy Garland in End of the Rainbow. Today, another Tony contender.
There, Bess, you don't need to be afraid no more. You picked up happiness and laid your worries down. You're gonna live easy, you're gonna live high, you're gonna outshine every woman in this town. And remember, when crown come, that's my business, Bess.
That's Norm Lewis as Porgy in The Gershwins, Porgy and Bess. He's up for a Tony for Best Actor in a Musical. His Bess, Audra McDonald, up for Best Actress, two of the show's 10 nominations. Porgy and Bess, the story of the fictional African-American fishing community Catfish Row in Charleston, South Carolina, circa 1930. Porgy, who can't walk. Bess, a drug addict and prostitute trying to accept his love. And, of course, the forces aligned against them. The Gershwins' Porgy and Bess originated at the American Repertory Theater here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, last summer. It arouses strong feelings in the African-American community. I asked my friend Beverly to go with me, and she said, no, I can't, never, because of the caricatures in it. On the other hand, here and now, pop culture critic Renee Graham, also African-American, loved it. What is it like to play Porgy when so many people have their own ideas about what he symbolizes? At the time, we asked now Tony nominee Norm Lewis. Even the program notes for the ART production point out that during the Civil Rights Movement, Porgy and Bess, which is considered one of America's greatest operas, became sort of radioactive for many African Americans because they felt it was something of a caricature. Mm-hmm. What about you when you came to the role? Did you have family discussions about it?
No, I knew about those discussions, but I didn't really focus on so much trying to get into the racial aspect of the show. I wanted to bring the truth. And back in that time in Catfish Row, people spoke a certain way. Now, we are choosing not to use some of the words that were originally put in the book, but I think we're just trying to find the truth of each character, and that's kind of been the basis of this whole process.
Well, but you say you didn't want to focus on the racial aspect, and yet we couldn't help but note that on your website, the first line of your bio points out that you grew up in Eatonville, Florida, the oldest black-chartered municipality in the U.S. So in shaping Porgy, what did you want him to be?
I wanted him to be someone who is seen with dignity and pride and you know, truth, basically. I mean, whether you like him or not, I mean, that's just like when I played Sweeney Todd, I was lucky enough to play that role, that character. I didn't want you to necessarily like him, but I wanted you to understand his plight. As far as the Eatonville, the aspect of me being in the black community, that helped a lot because I grew up in that sort of environment and that culture. So that helps me with this community, being that it is an all-black community in Catfish Row in South Carolina.
Well, let's listen to how Porgy, Norm Lewis, describes himself as someone who can't walk and is walked by and maybe invisible to people.
They look at my door and they keep on walking. I'm crippled from birth. God made me to be lonely. Nighttime, daytime.
Norm Lewis, how did you physically come to Porgy? Because Diane Paulus, the director, famously decided not to put him on his goat cart,
right.
Where he had been in past productions, although he had also been on crutches. You have him on one cane and this tortured, contorted walk. Mm-hmm. How'd you come to that?
Well, Diane and I, and also Ron K. Brown, who's our choreographer, we consulted with physical therapists who deal with people who are handicapped and came up with this particular movement. Something that wouldn't hurt me, you know, eight times a week, but something that would definitely be true on stage and look authentic.
Let's listen to a little of I Got Plenty of Nothing. At a certain point, do you have to sort of drop from your head, I am playing Porgy?
Yeah, I do. It's almost like being the president of the United States. I am in that line of these very famous Porgies and this iconic story. Todd Duncan, the original Porgy, I'm very proud of, and I feel I owe him honor and tribute because he really did something for us that was way before the Civil Rights Movement. And when they did an incarnation of the show in Washington, D.C., for the National Theater, he refused to go on unless it was a desegregated audience. I mean, this was in the 40s. And they threatened him. They did all kinds of things. But then he stood strong. And also the cast were behind him as well.
Huh. So that's some wind beneath your wings,
yes,
as well.
Yes, absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely.
So to our storyline, we heard Porgy lamenting that he was a cripple, mm-hmm. but then along comes Bess, played by Audra McDonald.
Yeah, she's I think she has
she
a future.
Can sing, yeah.
Yeah, she has a future.
The New York Times says she can now claim this role.
Yeah.
I was thinking when you were singing together, you are both physically strong.
Mm-hmm.
You would have to be because your voices, you could knock each other over. How does that feel to be in the wake of her voice?
It's just great. I mean, it's almost like playing a tennis player who is of equal level or better. You want to bring your game up, and that's what what I try to do every night with
mm-hmm.
her.
I'm wondering, too, we were reading an old article from the AP about Simon Estes,
mm.
who played Porgy at the Met in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And it points out that even though there are many African-American female opera stars, Marian Anderson, Leontine Price,
mm-hmm.
Jesse Norman, that it's more difficult for African-American male singers.
Yes, yeah. I was sleeping on my couch one night, and I think I woke up around 3 o'clock in the morning, and to my television still being on. And it was a documentary about African-Americans being in the classical world. Women are, you know, seem as damsel in distress or the exotic woman, and they get hired for those roles a lot of times. As far as black men, some guy who hires people in the operatic world, he said if there's a tenor, a black tenor and a white tenor, going for the same role, and they're equal, the white tenor will get it. Black men are not seen as heroes, at least in the operatic world, as far as the tenor roles. As the brother or as the father, you will see baritones and basses in these roles, but you don't really know of any famous tenor that's a black guy.
Is it a little bit easier in the Broadway world?
The musical theater world has changed a whole lot, and in fact, I'm a product of that. I've played Javert, I've played Sweeney Todd, I've played King Triton in Little Mermaid. I had a white daughter, so mm-hmm. it's when there are roles that are universal like that.
Norm Lewis, who stars as Porgy in the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. Just one question, having gone, would you like to look out and see more African-Americans in the audience?
Absolutely. And it's been great because there have been a lot of faces out there. I know that when it's marketed, I think the show The Color Purple proved that. When it's marketed to the community, a lot of times people will respond.
Norm Lewis, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Norm Lewis, Porgy in the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, we spoke last September. He's now up for a Tony for Best Actor in a Musical. We leave you with a little more of his performance.
Oh, Lord, I'm on my way.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service, MPRI. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.
All right. That long, long road, if you are there to guide my hand.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.